now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Welcome to Sincerely Sloan, presented by Uninterrupted. I'm your host, professional tennis player, wife, parent, and entrepreneur, Sloan Stevens. As an athlete and as a person, my journey has had a lot of twists and turns, from moments of adversity and doubt to unimaginable triumph and satisfaction. Throughout the season, I'm joined by some of the biggest names in sports, entertainment, culture, and a few members of my tribe. Our conversations keep it real and push it past skin deep. We reveal the perspectives, routines, and products that allow each of us to show up at our best. Join me on my journey of self-discovery and many, many laughs along the way. Sincerely, Sloan.
Hello, this is The Ruck, the rugby podcast from The Times and The Sunday Times. Happy Monday to you again. Welcome back. I'm Alfie Reynolds, and as always, or is pretty much always the case, I'm joined by Alex Lowe. All right, Alex?
Hello, yeah, morning.
Did you have a good Saturday at Twickenham?
Yeah, I did. I had a good weekend. It was at Bath Friday night.
Of course, yeah.
Two really contrasting games. Bath Saracens was like, beauty's in the eye of the beholder, right? Saracens went there and they turned it into a real kick fest and put Bath into an uncomfortable position and ended up winning the game. I was gripped by it. It wasn't a thriller in the same way as Harlequins Northampton was a high point scoring thriller, but that's rugby, right? No, it was good. And I was there on a bit of a busman's on Saturday, took my son to a game, and yeah, he loved it too. So it was a good rugby weekend.
Good weekend. Will Kelleher with us as well. You had the Sunday job of King's
Hello.
Home, Gloucester, Exeter.
Yeah, it was a bit sunnier. I think we're all still slightly bugged from winter, aren't we? You're a bit slightly under weather, Alfie.
I think I have been for over a week now, but yeah.
Yeah, but no, it was nicer in Gloucester, but a funny old game. I was travelling down to it thinking, I wonder what the piece is going to be today, because slightly less jeopardy on it, as Alex, you've written and spoken about on the pod recently, that Champions Cup qualification thing isn't really that exciting these days because 8 out of 10 get in. So I was thinking, well, what's the piece? So the only thing that Gloucester can do now is win the challenge, make it into the Champions Cup. But I put a line in my piece today being like, whether that's worth their while next season is another point. But yeah, then it ended up sort of being a piece about this kind of malaise that Gloucester have been in forever, really. Like, and someone made the good point when I tweeted out the article that you could probably compare that to Bath. Like, it's quite a similar existence, really, of just pottering along, finishing between 7th and 9th. The odd anomaly of a year where they finished 3rd with Danny Cipriani and then got thrashed by Saracens, which is often the way for those teams that have the odd season that's decent. And they had a season around the COVID time where they were doing well and dipped off and finished 5th. But their whole sort of decades of existence has kind of been meddling about in mediocrity and finishing kind of 9th. Usually they'll be 9th again this season. And the place was just really flat. The shed, it actually looked quite full, but because the shed's standing, I think there were quite a few fewer people in the shed than there should be. There was 11,000 odd.
It didn't look that full on TV.
No, but everyone stays. Like, it's a great place to go and watch rugby. The fans are awesome. Like, they're all going and finding players to talk to afterwards and stuff like that. But you just, I don't know, it just all felt really flat. And there's obvious reasons. Like, they're playing Benetton this Saturday in a Challenge Cup semi-final. And I think that's actually a really cool competition to win. Like, English teams have won it in the past, Welsh teams have won it, and it's been a really big day. And it's a good thing to win. But you just sort of think, I don't know, this existence of Gloucester kind of just muddling around has lasted too long. But it sounded like it resonated. And even afterwards, asking George Skivington, saying you could end the season with 2 trophies, does that look like a good year? Because not anyone else is going to do that. And he's like, well, not really, because that doesn't make our premiership form okay. Which kind of validated the piece I'd done and kind of updated it with some of his thoughts too. And it's just that interesting thing. You see, I think they're cutting their cloth, or have been cutting their cloth out since COVID and everything else, like a lot of teams have been doing. But you see other teams like Northampton not paying to the cap, and their coaching is fantastic and their academy setup's brilliant. They're clearly a well-managed club, doing well in a semi-final this week of the top comp and top of the league. You think it's just interesting how there are certain clubs that just never get out of this cycle. And Bath have been one. And we'll get onto them. But you still think now could be another season where you go, ah, not quite, Bath, not quite. It's just interesting. Like, you have the odd team like Leicester who go up and win the title, but they're largely in this malaise period too. But at least they've had a year where they were really good. Quins have had a couple of years where they've won stuff. Sale have made a final. But there are some teams that just sort of exist in 7 to 9 and below.
And Gloucester are one of those at the moment,
yeah,
it seems. So, well, we've already started getting into it, but we'll get into all the Premiership stuff from the weekend. I've also had a chat on Sunday with Rocky Clark, formerly the record caps holder for England before Sarah Hunter came and pipped her to that title. But to look back on the Women's Six Nations, I'll have a chat with Rocky about that. And we'll have a quick look ahead to the Champions Cup semi-final coming up this weekend. In terms of the Premiership, going back to that Friday night game, Alex, with Saracens just pipping Bath, it was really interesting. Nick Mullins on TNT commentary, I think midway through the first half, asked the question to his co-coms to the effect of, does the sport have a problem when we're served up this for the first 25 minutes? And I think what he meant was second against third, big game in terms of the top four, and it was attritional, wasn't it? It was box kicking, it was tactical. Now, I don't have a problem with it. I think, hinting at what you were saying before, if we love our rugby, you can find enjoyment in that sort of game. But does Nick have a point? Can you kind of see what he's getting at?
I can see what he's getting at. I know where he's coming from. And if I'd spent £100 on a ticket, I might have felt a bit shortchanged by the lack of open rugby that I saw. But I don't think the game's got a problem, because the beauty of the game is that it can be won in multiple ways. If every game of rugby was played like that, the game would have a problem, because you're not showing enough of the players' skill sets to the fore, bringing enough of the players' skill sets to the fore. But on the odd occasion when it happens, a tight attritional game can be compelling. Now, this was a strategy that Saracens brought because they know that Bath are at their most dangerous when they're on the front foot, they're recycling quickly, and they can release Cockensinger and Ollie Lawrence into space. And so Saracens, they disrupted as much as possible what Bath could do. And so Bath had opportunities to score tries, but their accuracy wasn't there. And it felt to me like Bath were forcing it because they were trying to force their way out of this kicking battle, this tactical battle that Saracens had drawn them into. And because they were trying to force their way out of it, it just didn't quite click for them. So they played this kicking game, but at all times I felt they were assessing, waiting for the moment when they could then strike. And they scored two really good tries. Ironically for Bath, their way back in was sending on two new props. They won a scrum penalty. And that's where I come to about why these games can be great in their own right. The scrum penalty they won turned the whole game. Bath go and kick that scrum penalty to the corner, score a maul try, come back again, score another maul try with Cam Redpath popping up on the back. Suddenly, from nowhere, on the back of a scrum pen, it's 12-all. And you're wondering now, the momentum has shifted. And what Saracens did so well was suck up everything that Bath threw at them. The defence was brilliant. And then, like I say, they still have their heads up. Farrell spots an opportunity to run out of his own 22. Lovely offload. Great feat from Nick Tompkins. Theo Dan is suddenly searing downfield. Kicks ahead. The bounce of the ball goes Saracens' way. Cam Redpath has to be tackled over his own line. 5 metre scrum. And on the back of that pressure comes a winning penalty. Now, you don't have the momentum shifts that you had at Twickenham on Saturday, where it was a points fest, but it meant that each momentum shift became more important in its own right. So I understand it's hard to sell a game of rugby to casual viewers. Like, if that game had been on ITV and you've got casual viewers, that's a hard sell. I completely appreciate that. But it has its place in the pantheon of rugby because of the light and shade that you can get with it. And that scrum penalty, you know, was one of the big moments in the game. And then Sarri's wrestling it back and going down the other end to win the game. Like, there's a beauty in that as well, I think.
I think particularly given the fact that it's the race for the top four as well, I think I would understand frustration with that sort of game more if it was earlier in the season, as silly as that sounds, when it just feels like another game. But because it was top four, it was second against third, it was Bath, Sarries, I almost didn't mind because of that.
And also, it stands in contrast to what we've been seeing. So I think this season, Premiership matches are averaging more than 7 tries per game, which is a huge outlier compared to pretty much any competition in the world. It's up there with Super Rugby a bit, but it's probably even beyond that. And just purely looking at the number of kicks per games over this weekend, so it's a massive variation. So bottom of the list between them, Leicester and Bristol kicked the ball 35 times. Sale Newcastle 42 times. Quinn's Saints was 50. Gloucester Exeter 51. Bath Saracens 90. But as you've both said, if all games were 90 kicks and it was like 12, 15 every week, we'd go, blimey, maybe we need to change something about this. But actually, that Bath Saracens game was an interesting outlier to what we've been seeing, which is more of this basketball thing. Or, like, personally, I found the game way, way, way more entertaining and interesting than Gloucester-Exeter, which was just kind of, Gloucester aren't very good, Exeter got more to play for, put them away quite easily, they're 38-17 with 20 minutes to go, and then the game dies.
So in terms of top four then, Northampton still top on 55 points, then Sarri second, 51, Bath on 50, Bristol and Quinns both on 49, Bristol currently fourth because they've won more games, and then Sale's victory means they're sixth, Exeter seventh, and Leicester eighth, and Leicester now, technically, they're not completely out of it, but they are out of it. So I was at Twickenham reporting on the Harlequins-Northampton game, was kind of keeping an eye on the Bristol score and saw that it was 19-0 pretty late on and were thinking, well, that's it then. Bristol coming back into it, 3 tries, conversion to win it right at the end. Huge win for them. For Leicester, though, I messaged someone that covers Leicester a lot and they kind of just gave this great sense of frustration, I think some anger after the game at the weekend, questions about Dan McKellar and quite where the club is at the moment. But yeah, they've just kind of dropped away, haven't they, this year?
Hugely, hugely. And we're talking about Gloucester at the top of it, having this kind of 20-odd year malaise. That's Leicester, but they've had the anomalous year where they won the title with Borthwick. And now it seems like they've kind of reverted to back to the sort of average served up
but
forever.
I think Leicester's journey is different to Gloucester's. Like, Gloucester's feel like they just can't haul themselves out of that sort of lower mid-table. Whereas Leicester had a downward spiral to the point where they hit rock bottom and would have been
relegated in
any other year. Obviously, Saracens were forcibly relegated. And then the bounce back under Steve Borthwick was so far ahead of schedule that I wonder if it's given a slightly false impression of where the club is in terms of its renewal from hitting rock bottom. Yeah, they've lost big name players. They lost George Ford, for example, after that title year. They're having to rebuild still from the collapse in a way. And I wonder whether, as great as that title campaign was, and Borthwick got them there in two huge leaps, didn't he, whether that slightly skews everyone's expectations of what Leicester should achieve. Now, it is Leicester. It's the biggest club stadium in the country, biggest club in the country by a lot of measures. They've won everything. It's not unfair for Leicester fans to expect their team to be doing better than they've done this season, to be competing for a semi-final place going into the last few rounds. Don't think that's unreasonable for Leicester fans. But I wonder whether their expectation of what this team should be achieving under Dan McKellar slightly skewed by an overachievement over those couple of years under Borthwick.
There's such a neat comparison with Man United, isn't there?
Was
the comparison back when both teams were very good in the noughties, and there's such a neat comparison now, apart from the fact that Man United haven't recently won a title. Just that thing of the big, historical, successful club with the history of why are we not still there, the big ground, the massive support, that are just moving from one thing to the other and never quite getting it right, never divorcing themselves from their amazing history, still leaning back on stuff that happened quite a long time ago.
Well, sorry to interrupt, Will. I was just going to say that I've seen talk of Dan McKellar's project having run out of time, and I don't buy that at all. I think he's a class coach, and I think the project that he's there to do is, you know, we think of Leicester as a title winning team recently, but it's actually a bit deeper than that. And I think the people they've got there are good people who will take the club in the right direction. We've got the NFL drafts on at the moment, and you watch these teams selecting the best young players and then releasing really... it's all about squad management. And I think under the salary cap now, that squad management and recruitment and retention is so important that you can lose one or two, and it can shift the balance massively in what you can achieve. And that's a huge part of it. You can turn things around pretty quickly, but retaining a team that is successful is really hard. Like, that that team, that Leicester team that won the title, immediately lost arguably their two most important players in George Ford and Ellis Genge. And Andre Pollard is world class, don't get me wrong, but
he hasn't been for them.
But he hasn't been for them. No, you're right. And now they're
definitely not a good.
You look at the number of players that they've carried, a lot of players in that squad. Like Nick Dolly's leaving.
I mean, like Jasper Visa leaving. Like there's some big.
He's not been a passenger. There's a lot of players there who burn brightly for a year. Like Guy Porter is an England international. Nick Dolly is an England international. They just don't feature now. Like there's a squad revamp taking place, which Dan McKellar will have his hands all over.
And Leicester fans listening to this would also be quick to point out that no attack coach for a lot of this year, and a lot of the criticism you hear about this Leicester team is they can still be in an arm wrestle and keep it tight, but their attack looks pretty blunt.
They can't score tries. But I think that on a sort of wider point, which maybe leads us back to Twickenham and refereeing and things, is that I do think we have, I mean, maybe this is a wider societal point too. We see this with elections, don't we? Where X is not the real life. Twitter is not real life. People who are loud and angry on social media, which is why Leicester had to put out that statement being like, come on, everyone, let's calm down and stop abusing our players. That doesn't necessarily mean that's actually happening in the wider world, does it? I find it just interesting that you would probably meet normal fans in pubs and in clubhouses and stuff like that who are way less militant and angry and had a few pints and said something they regret on social media than the people that live their lives on keyboards and stuff like that. So it does give a false sense, I think, of maybe the anger that's around it. Like, clearly, there'll be lots of people standing on the Crumbie Terrace going, I'm sick of this rubbish season, as they will be in the shed.
Like, that's fine.
But I don't think there's probably quite that aggression that comes across on social media.
And talking of controversy, it brings us back to Twickenham, Carl Dixon, and the lack of a second yellow card for Danny Kerr. Cynical play, got subbed off immediately after Will Porter comes on and scores a couple of tries.
Can I jump in on a? I was asking people about this yesterday and don't really know if there's an answer. We can chat about it maybe. But do we think why particularly does Carl Dixon annoy people? Do we think, like, he seems to get way more of this than Christoph Ridley, Craig Maxwell Keyes. You could name any other, Ian Tempest,
referees. I mean, I'm just thinking,
is it because people think he's been promoted quickly because he was a former player and they want him to get up the ranks fast and he's done big games, maybe above his experience level? I don't know.
Like, I don't know. He clearly deserves his place. He's been involved in a couple of incidents which have caused people. There was one at Welford Road where, did he disallow a try because, what happened? He penalised someone for diving on the player.
That was the Ollie Woodburn one that ended up with Jack Knoll getting a fine for saying that's the worst decision I've ever seen in my life. Yeah.
Yeah, and yet it...
End of last season.
And yet he was backed by the officials. And I think there's another conversation around... Well, no, it's part of this, referee judgment versus what the laws say. To digress slightly, Friday night, right at the end, so the winning penalty, Farrell was going to take up every available second of it because he's now allowed to, because they've put 60 seconds on it. A week earlier, Luke Pearce had told Finn Smith that he had to hurry up because it was a kick under the posts. It was against the spirit of the game to eke out every second. And it was pretty clear that the refereeing authorities thought Luke Pearce was in the wrong for doing that because a kicker is allowed 60 seconds. So then at the rec, he gave Owen Farrell a countdown, like every 5 seconds. Now, for me, you couldn't see the shot clock, but he should have just said to Farrell, right, your time limit on the match clock on the screen is, whatever it was, 76:15, say. Then Farrell can take it into his own hands because there is a material benefit to Bath if he messes up. But I think Luke felt he had to do that because he clearly had a rap over the knuckles from the week before, which brings me on to my point, which is I think Luke Pearce was in the right the week before to hurry the kick up. Putting 60 seconds on a penalty kick, which also comes off the match clock, for me is way too long. And the referee is the sole arbiter on the field. And if he says, stop wasting time, you don't need to take a minute to chip it over the posts, between the posts, hurry up, then it should be the referee's right to do that. So for me, that law, you either take off the shot clock and the referee has to manage the situation, or you reduce the shot clock.
Definitely reduce the time.
I'd reduce it.
I sort of quite like the gamesmanship angle of it, though. Like the sort of housery of waiting and grinning and going,
of course, I don't mind it because it's perfectly allowed. It's perfectly allowed, but I don't think... Luke Pearce found himself in two completely contrasting situations, and I think he was in the right And it comes back to what I was saying about referee judgment. The regulations are that a kicker has 60 seconds, but there is a spirit of rugby element to this. Of like, should you be allowed? Is it the right thing for the game for someone to sit there for 58 seconds before just chipping it over the bar? I would side with Luke Pearce on
You'll
that.
You'll get MCC members booing you off the field if the spirit of cricket.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, so then to link it to what happened at Twickenham, there were two incidents, weren't there, with Danny Kerr? So the game's in a balance. I think Quins are 5-6 points ahead. They're one score ahead in this end-to-end game. Northampton line break, go downfield, a tackle's made. Danny Kerr dives over the top of the tackle and disrupts the ball from Alex Mitchell.
Having
pushed James Ram out of the way. For which, ultimately, that's what he was penalised for. I don't think there's a yellow card in it, weirdly.
Really?
I don't think there's a yellow card in either of them. If you look at it...
I thought he killed the ball. I thought he dived off his feet, killed the ball, took out Alex Mitchell like it was so cynical.
I know, but the ball is not on the ground. I can't remember who got tackled.
It was Alex Mitchell picking up the ball at the back of
the ruck. Yeah, but he wasn't. Whoever got tackled still had the ball in his hands and was passing it to Alex Mitchell. No ruck had formed. So I think the ball's there to be... I think Danny Kerr's okay to go and tackle Alex Mitchell because he's got the ball in his hands.
Yeah.
And there's no ruck.
It was one of those that, if we use the football one, of it looked like a professional foul, didn't it?
It
looked like
totally
when you're the sort
like
of
it.
Second to last defender and you just
totally
leave one on
like
someone
it.
To take them out because otherwise they're going to go and
totally
score.
Totally like it. And the shove, I saw Ben Kay saying he was okay with Kerr basically tackling Alex Mitchell. He thought that the shove on James Ram was a yellow card. But I don't think it is because Ram has overrun. He's run a line.
He was clearing
to try and get
out
an offload.
Another
he was
defender.
Gone. He was beyond. So the idea that Kerr had stopped him from being able to enter the ruck.
I agree with that. He was beyond the ball. Yeah.
Is erroneous because he's beyond the ball. So Kerr is now just moving out of the way to stop him blocking what his entry to the tackle area. So I actually. Like, both of them look like they could be yellow cards, but I'm not sure either are yellow cards, and which comes down to judgment. It's a referee. It's one of those grey areas. Like, what's the ball? If it's, let's say a ruck's formed, the ball's only out of the ruck when either it's behind the hindmost foot or the scrum half picks it up off the floor. But what if there is no ruck and the tackle player is presenting the ball in the air to the scrum half? The scrum half's got his hands on it. He's there to be tackled,
yeah.
Surely.
Yeah. I think and Elgin wrote a good piece about this, sort of a comment about... And actually, it was a good piece, but I don't necessarily agree with the conclusion he came to, because I think he's right. When people can find the piece on the Times, it'll be up there at the moment, because Elgin was covering the game and wrote about it on Sunday. But I think he's right to say that, of course, Carl Dixon isn't going, oh, hang on, I played for Harlequins 7 or 8 years ago, so therefore I'm going to not give a card to someone I used to sit behind as a scrum half. Also, as a by-the-by, he missed an absolutely obvious forward pass for Saints early in the game. So it's a bit like, all right, so who's he being biased towards now? Where are we on this whole bias thing?
And three Quins players did get sin-binned
in
the game.
And pretty, like... They were pretty much right. Like, the liner one was a classic slap down. Kerr was possibly a bit unlucky because he was kind of falling in the tackle, but he was too high to start with. Anyway,
Danny Kerr being too high tackling Courtney Lawson.
I know,
But
it looked odd, but
it was one.
Like,
it was one of those that by the way the games are now being reffed, it was a yellow. But there's not much Danny Kerr could do differently when given the dynamic of the situation. He's unfortunate in a way that Courtney came down onto him. But it was a yellow.
The wider point is, and like there's sort of two elements to this, but because I absolutely hate rugby thinking it's better than every other sport and going, oh, this isn't very rugby values, hashtag rugby family kind of stuff. You're like, come on, like, guys, this is not a better sport than football, cricket, anything else. Like, let's just park that whole debate. But I also don't like the fact that we're then now going to decide that Carl Dixon can't referee Quins because there are idiots on social media who will make a big deal about it. Like, why do we have to pander to the kind of like mob rule?
It seems to be something that's sprung up in the last couple of weeks, because a lot of people said about Christoph Ridley before the East Midlands
Derby. He was in the Tigers Academy.
It's kind of, where's this come from?
Nonsense.
Really?
Like, what if Andy Goode wanted to become a referee? He's played for like two-thirds of the...
Chris Ashton.
Premiership. Chris Ashton the same, right?
Yeah.
It's a nonsense argument. And I think the game is not helped by any insinuation that Carl Dixon will do anything other than referee what he sees in front of him. The problem is that there aren't that many pro refs. He's at international level. And the Premiership, there are only five games a weekend. So you're immediately saying he can never do a Harlequins game.
What if
he's the best ref and Quins are in the Prem final? You're saying he can't do the final?
Would prefer to have a worse referee because some bloke on Twitter's got a problem with it.
I would say to any trained referees, please email in and tell me I'm wrong about the two yellow cards. I'd be delighted to know what other people think.
I obviously do not fit that category of expertise, but I thought it was a yellow card. And I think the
fact... For which one?
For the second one, for the Danny Care kind of off the
feet. Sorry, no, for the shove on James Ram or for the diving over the top?
I thought diving over the top. And I felt like, and I'm sure some Saints fans might point towards this, the fact that Carl Dixon immediately went to his pocket and then kind of stopped and checked with the assistant, went to the TMO.
That's a good thing, right?
Well, maybe, but I also think his referee instinct was that is clearly a fairly blatant yellow card.
Maybe, but I think he thought what I thought, which is that the ball's on the floor and he just dived and killed the ball. And if he immediately thought that, then he would have thought yellow. But maybe something told him that there's something.
It isn't
what happened.
There was a fight that stopped him.
There was then Alex. I mean, Danny Kess, Alex Mitchell helped me because he shoved Etta Hazen. But I don't know. The ball's not on the floor, so I don't know how he can have killed it.
Well, maybe the fact that we disagree shows there's more nuance to it than perhaps seeing things on social media would suggest.
One last point: the RFU. Not to everyone, but to TNT Sports on Sunday, issued a clarification as to why that decision was made, which I think is absolutely the right thing. Absolutely the right thing. We've spoke about this on the pod. The referees want to be able to explain how they came to a decision.
So let them do it, yeah.
So let them do it. Let Carl Dixon come on the telly. I mean, I asked him this question at the launch of the Whistleblowers documentary, and he's like, he's up for it. Let him come on the ruck on a Monday and say, well, this is what I saw, and this is why I made the decision. You can then disagree with his judgment if you want. You know, you're perfectly entitled to disagree and think he should have made a different decision. But so many of the calls that referees have to make in a game of rugby are judging a situation in a grey area, that if Carl Dixon's sitting here on the ruck on a Monday to say, well, this is what I saw with the shove, and this is what I saw when he dived over the top, or this is what collectively we saw as a team, more to the point, then I think that does the referees a huge service.
Do you not think we already get that, though, in rugby? The fact that the fact that we can hear the referees, we can hear the TMO, we can hear the conversations that are happening. Like, would it actually achieve...
A little bit, but I think sometimes the communication on the field...
Is different to...
Is different because it's in the heat of the
moment. They're going through a checklist rather than, like, fully explaining the whole context, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah. I think it would just allow... It would take the heat out of so many...
I totally agree, yeah.
Situations. And the fact the RFU kind of issued some clarification, for me, is a step in the right direction.
But also, like, the other intended consequence of doing that is that you also humanise the people that you're seeing refereeing. So you know them. You're like, oh, yeah, that's Carl Dixon. I've heard him on the pod and I've heard him explain this, that and the other. Like, I feel like there are a few referees who've got to that stage where you go, yeah, Luke Pearce, he looks like a decent bloke and he's a good referee. Wayne Barnes got there, Nigel Owens, different way, whatever. That's always going to help, isn't it? Just to be like, these guys are humans. They're making a decision like you are. They're the expert. Let them crack on. It's never going to be perfect. And, like, they're clearly not biased.
Well, as Alex says, any referees or anyone that wants to get in touch, theruck@thetimes.co.uk is the email address that you can. We'll have to leave the Premiership chat there. We could probably go on for ages. Maybe next week I want to have a chat more about the run-in, because it's fascinating looking at the final couple of fixtures that the different teams have as well. Just for example, Saracens have got Bristol away and then Sale at home. So Bristol have got that Sarries game, but then they've got Harlequins away on the final weekend. Like, it's so... delicately poised.
Can I make a tiny really quick point? That I feel like this is a season where you just sort of forget about teams for months and then you go, oh yeah, God, they're in there. So like Bristol, classic case in point, where a few weeks ago we go like, oh wow, Bristol, and then you're like, oh wow, they're fourth, and like still Sale just nipping in there. Like,
yeah, because
another win.
Sale have Leicester at home and then Sarries away, so that like, Sarries away game's thing. Massive, but Leicester at home you'd say is very winnable. Yeah. Then they're going into the final weekend with it in their hands, possibly.
Chiefs think they're in the running, which they are, but they need to win two games and get 10 points, really. But Sale are more in the running on that basis because they're 2 points ahead of them. And they won, they beat Newcastle. So you're thinking like, well, I don't know.
Bath play Newcastle. So that, you know, if Sarries slip up somewhere, Bath can expect a 5-pointer there, which will put, I mean, it is great. And Bristol, the way they won that from 19-0 down with 10 minutes to go, like mad finish. It's brilliant. The Rondon's brilliant.
Very last hot take. I think that Bath-Sarries result was total canary down the mine territory. The canary's dead. Bath are gone. Like I can't see that. I can't see them doing it now.
Even though they got Newcastle,
you know. But no, they'll get in. They'll get in, but then they'll lose to Sarries.
Oh, I see. You think they'll go to the Stoke?
That was
and
such a game where you were like, if they can't do it, then they're not going to do it.
All right, well, we'll park the Premiership chat there. More of that on next week's podcast. Up next, I review the end of the Women's Six Nations, another Grand Slam for England. On Sunday evening, I had a chat with the person with the second most caps for England, Rocky Clark, as we look back on all the action. Well, Rocky, great to have you on the podcast. Thanks for your time. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, thank you. I even got some minutes under my belt yesterday, so I'm a little bit sore today, but delighted with all the fantastic rugby that's gone on.
Where were you playing? What were you up to?
So we had a friendly for the county team that I coach, and we only had 16, so I wasn't really supposed to play, but, you know, got my boots and went on, and I loved it. You know, can't keep me away from it. So, yeah, it was a lot of fun, and we had a friendly against OAs too, so a good weekend.
I was going to say, because I follow you on socials, and you are often playing, aren't you? I know you're retired now, but you obviously still love it.
Yes, I do. Yeah, so I play for Championship side Buckingham Swans. So I love having a little run out. Happy to sit on the bench and just, you know, roll out, waddle on, see what I can do, and you know, teach youngsters a thing or two, or get run around, of course, either or.
I can imagine it's teaching them a thing or two. But let's get into the end of the Women's Six Nations then. So England, another Grand Slam. As expected, they're champions again. France are second again. It's a bit more competitive below those two, which we'll maybe get into. Starting off quite broadly speaking, what do you make of the Six Nations this year?
Yeah, I think, you know, certainly the top half has gone as expected. You know, England seem to be so far ahead, and that gap maybe is just slightly reducing, maybe not in some circumstances, but the strength and depth from England is just so hard to compete with. And obviously France gave them a good match yesterday, but, you know, we're never in a position where we're worried that England are going to lose. But sort of below that, those guys, you know, Ireland have done really, really well considering they had a huge loss against England. But with Scott Beamans, who's gone in and made such a difference, their defensive outlook, their kicking, their tactics have already made a difference with him being there. Another year of him, you know, putting his pennies worth in and getting the skills right up there, I think that will make a huge difference. Scotland in fourth place, maybe a little bit disappointed with that. Potentially a couple of wins they could have had themselves. And then sad to see Wales right down there at the bottom. They started really well sort of 2 or 3 years ago when they just went professional. And it's a shame to see them make their way down the table rather than keeping in the top half. However, they did get a really important win yesterday against Italy. And I guess most people would have written them off.
Yeah, as you mentioned with England there, we all expect them to win, don't we? Because they have made a habit of that. They're clearly ahead of everyone else, which is something we've spoken about a lot on the pod over the course of this Six Nations. How do you judge England then? Is it, obviously, congratulations to them, great job, deserved winners, but is it more about the performances? And if that is the case, then what did you make of them? And I suppose their first championship we've seen them under John Mitchell.
Yeah, you can definitely see how Mitchell's made a difference already. You know, he's taken them away from the era of Simon Middleton. But what I like about his coaching, there's an all-court style game that they've still got the territory game, the line out, the mauls, you know, which England heavily relied on under Simon Middleton. But they're also, what I'm loving seeing is their backline play a real freedom. And obviously Ellie Kildare, who scored loads of tries this Six Nations, it's been good to see the ball get in her hands. There's still things that need improving. Quality of passing, pass accuracy, a few things for them to work on. You know, it's easy to say when they win 88-10 that, you know, England are amazing, but there are still faults there. And if you play the best teams in the world, you need to be able to execute under pressure. Unfortunately, the gulf in the Six Nations is so big. You know, we only really talk about one potentially close game or Six Nations decider at the moment. So I'm hoping over the next few years, once other teams, and it's their job to catch up, and fair play to England, keep pushing the way forward. They just keep getting better and better, and Mitchell has certainly added to that.
How much has it changed since you were playing, Rocky? I know that wasn't that long ago now, but we talk about professionalism and the professional contracts that the RFU have implemented and those central contracts. Do you look at this Six Nations now And does it feel like a very different landscape to when you were playing, or actually is it not too far removed from that?
Bits and bobs overlap. You know, what's brilliant now is that a youngster can, you know, dream to be an England player and that can be their job. I obviously never had that. I went fully professional in my last year. And I just wonder, you know, how much of a difference that would have made on my 15-year international career. But you got youngsters like Meg Jones, who are absolute worldies at the moment, and she's never had another job. She's only ever been a professional rugby player. And like for girls to see that and can aspire to that, that is really significant. And the, you know, the quality of rest time, the recovery, the time they have off is huge to how well they can perform. And you know, there perhaps is a little difference in money that has been given as well against other home nations, and that's a whole nother talking point. But you know, I want to see this bridge gap close, the gap close. I want to see teams more competitive, because we're going to get more fans that way, aren't we?
Yeah, totally. In fact, it's something we've seen across the championship, hasn't it? I know Scotland sold out the Hive. I think it was a record attendance for the game at the weekend in France, between France and England. So that's heading in one direction. Let's talk about some of the other teams, though. Ireland and Scotland. So Ireland with a 15-12 win. Massive win for Ireland, this, isn't it? They have been through, let's be frank, a pretty tough period, particularly with all the off-field issues. But finishing third, they qualify for WXV1 and they qualify for next year's World Cup. That is a brilliant Six Nations for them.
Yeah, for Ireland, you know, and it's so pleasing to see, because they were back in their heyday, sort of 2014, 2015, they were at the top of their game. And obviously they beat New Zealand in the World Cup in the pool game. And it was, you know, that was in there at their prime. And then we've just seen them dwindle, and all their long-term players have sort of gone out of the squad. So they've had to massively rebuild. And like you said, there's a lot of politics that's gone off the field as well. But great to see players like Cliona Baloney back into the squad under Scott Beaman. She's made a big difference. The youngsters they've got in, they're breeding these youngsters who are coming up through the system and the ranks now. And I can't wait to see them prosper under the guise of Scott Beaman, as well as the quality of the competition as well. And we're seeing a lot of fruits of the nature come from the PWR and the quality of the standards of women's rugby in Ireland and England are massively going up.
And how, on the flip side, how do we analyse Scotland? So on the one hand, I think this was a way more positive Six Nations than we've seen previously. They could have beaten Ireland this weekend. They got pretty close to France in that home game they had as well. It could look like a really different complexion to this championship. So is there a frustration that they themselves haven't finished third for the qualification and things I just mentioned? Or actually, do they look at it and it's undoubted that they have made some pretty big step forwards?
Yeah, a real mixed bag for them, I'd say, because you talk about those two games and they've only lost it by like sort of about a try or less. And you're thinking, you know, if they could just maybe get some more points on board in terms of kicking penalties rather than going for corners. You know, they're in these games, they're tight in the games. And I think the gap has closed between sort of Scotland and France. Other teams seem to be getting a bit closer to France. And that gap is closing. But we just somehow, like I said earlier, England is still managing to keep their head well above the water. But Scotland can take a lot of confidence from that, but also a lot of frustration, because there could have easily been those two extra wins, which would have made a massive difference to the table.
And let's just finish off with Wales, who had to wait a long time for a victory, but it finally came, 22-20 against Italy at the Principality Stadium. It hasn't been a great Six Nations for Wales. They'll be delighted to finish with that victory. They still finished bottom just because Italy picked up more bonus points. So despite the fact they both only won one game, the Italians sit above them. Where are you with Wales at the moment? Good finish to the championship, but it feels to me there's been some reality checks this Six Nations in terms of where the professional pathways are. I know they brought in these contracts a couple of years ago, but we're maybe not quite seeing the steps forward yet that the WRU might have been hoping for.
Completely agree. You know, when they first went professional, we saw a big, you know, rise in the quality of their performances, their fitness levels. And you kind of was hoping that trajectory would have kept going. but something's not quite adding up to why they're underperforming. And they're, you know, unfortunately, they've been slightly underwhelming during the Six Nations and not scoring particularly a lot of tries. So, yeah, it's great for them to finish with that. And I know some of the players are really frustrated with how they've performed, and that isn't their usual standard. So I think they'll really have a strong, hard look at themselves and hopefully come back fighting.
Yeah, well, an interesting Six Nations as ever, not without its issues, which are well documented, and certainly not England's fault that they are so far ahead of the rest at the moment. Rocky, just finally, I haven't teed you up for this one, so I'm just going to throw it at you. If you had to name a player of the championship, who would be getting your nomination?
Okay, so I'd probably say the girl that's been in all the headlines, Ellie Kildunn. I think we're going to struggle to see somebody else competing with that. But Meg Jones, for me, has been a player of the tournament, as well as Alex Matthews. You know, I am a bit biased, all England perhaps, but they have just been absolute quality throughout the tournament. And every week they've been your top three.
Yeah, Kildunn or Matthews would probably be the two that would get my nomination. But there's certainly a lot of candidates there within the England team. Rocky, thank you for speaking to us on the pod. Much appreciated. Hopefully we'll get you back on at some time in the not too distant future. But all the best coaching, playing when you are as well. And no doubt I'll see you at a stadium soon at some point.
Brilliant. Thank you.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Thank you to Rocky Clark. Great to have her on the pod and looking back on the Women's Six Nations. We're going to be naming our God or Goddess of the Week fairly shortly, but back with Will and Alex. Before that, Leinster Northampton, Toulouse Harlequins, two great semi-finals, possibly on paper at least one-sided, but we thought that ahead of Harlequins facing Bordeaux in the quarterfinal. So it's a case of seeing what Saints and Quins are able to throw up this weekend. Will, you're going to be at...
We mentioned it briefly on our Quins special the other day, but slightly roundabout route. I'm going on Saturday to Bordeaux, staying in Bordeaux, getting a train from Bordeaux to Toulouse, going to the match, then coming home from Bordeaux. So yes, but looking forward to it. I think it's going to be good. And I sent this to you on WhatsApp. Like we mention him every now and then. The stats guru Russ Petty has come up with. So we mention this the other week about the semi-finals in the Premiership are always actually not as exciting as we think they are, and like 100% the same in the Champions Cup. So we're hoping there's something that changes that, because he listed all the semi-finals from the start of the competition and how few people win away. And the great stat is there's been one semi-final win away from home since 2017, and that game was an all-French tie. And it was La Rochelle. So La Rochelle are always the team that break these little things about no one's won in South Africa, no one's won at whatever. So they beat Racing 20 points to 13 in 2022. And before that, if you are looking at teams from different countries that played each other, someone's won away from home. The last time that happened was Saracens beating Munster in the Aviva in Dublin back in 2017. So we'll get Quins fans going, you'll write us off. But there's the historical facts of the matter for both Northampton and for Quins. A win this weekend would be utterly remarkable, and like we would love to see it. It would be awesome, but it does look deigned to be a Leinster Toulouse final. Let's see what they can do to disrupt that, though.
But Alex, is that not the narrative for both of those clubs this week? First of all, what a brilliant opportunity for both of them. Historic in terms of this stage of the competition, and no one expects them to do anything.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Quins will go to Toulouse and take the same mindset with them that saw them win in Bordeaux and saw them beat Northampton. The weakest part of their game is their defence. So they'll go down to Toulouse and just engage in a race to...
It could be mental. It could be nuts.
Like, they could get blown away. Yeah. Or if they... What I like about that Quins mindset is because they're there, sort of Kevin Keegan rugby, they're like, well, they'll... No, they'll score three, so we'll score four type of thing. That's the way they're going.
Baz balls. It's Baz ball. It could be 50 all out or 400 for none, couldn't they?
So they're going to go down and, yeah, to use the analogy of the Easy Border, they're going to go and swing the bat and have a go. Northampton into 82,000 Croke Park. Just what an experience for... They've got such a young... So many exciting young English players. That's a hell of a stage for them. I mean, to go... Well, the stats tell it all, but just if you even just imagine just this one scenario, like stepping out into Croke Park, which is enormous, and it's going to be clad in blue with like the odd like green, black, and gold somewhere in the corners. If Quins or Northampton could pull one off, it would be a victory for the ages.
So 2 points. I think there's a slight bit of smugness in Premiership Towers about the fact that they've got two in the semis because
we all wrote them off at
well
the start,
no or... but more so because we did an article with, and others did too, but met the president of the LNR, the French league, who was very derogatory about the Premiership and laughing about Bath, the dreamers at Bath, and I always have to go there and bring my umbrella. They always tell me they're building a stadium and I never see it. I have to bring my parapluie, my umbrella, to go and see Bruce Craig and that. And so they're going like, all right, well done, you've got what, one team in the... Okay, and we got two. Okay, fair enough. So there's a little bit of that, and like, fair play to both Quins and Saints, because Saints, as we keep saying, not playing to the salary cap, they're playing against these mega clubs and beating them, like, fair enough. But I'm really fascinated by the Leinster psychology. So this is a team that we all sort of assume that everything's in their own backyard, everything goes their way, they've got the best team, they've got the whole island side, whatever, but they haven't won. They've lost three finals, a semi and a quarter final since they last won it. And it's all Saracens and La Rochelle, but they haven't won this tournament since 2018, and they haven't won the URC for a couple of years either. And as much as it's like, here you go, their party, brilliant, well done them, you're like, that must be a massive pressure upon them. Croke Park, 82,000, it's your semi-final, you're going to win it, everything's gone to you. So that's surely what Saints got to play on this week.
What I'm looking forward to is watching Finn Smith in that game. I really think he's the real deal. And we saw in the way that Northampton beat Munster away in horrific conditions, the way he managed that. They were down to 14 men as well, weren't they? The way he managed that game and won that game for them. This is the kind of stage that I really feel he's made for, and doesn't mean he's going to go and beat them on his own, but just, I think we will learn a huge amount about, more than we learned. He did all right coming off the bench for England in the early Six Nations games, but this is the biggest stage so far of his young career, and I think we could learn a hell of a lot about how far he's going to go on the weekend, and like, I'd back him to step up to the stage.
We're looking forward to watching those two semi-finals this weekend. We will review them on next week's episode. Let's finish off this week, though, as we always do, God or Goddess of the Week. I'll start us off. I was going to go for Luke Northmore, who was making his first Premiership start since October in Quins' victory over Northampton. Scored a couple of tries. He had that brilliant season, didn't he, a year or so ago, where he was in outstanding form, and he's had massive issue with injuries so far this year, hence the fact that he's only starting in the Premiership for the first time since October at the weekend just gone. But good to see him back out there. So Luke Northmore is my nomination.
Nice shout. I always give two answers, don't I? So my honourable mention is going to be to Henry Slade, who had one of those games where you just go like, God, Henry Slade's good at rugby, isn't he? Like, he just sort of drips with quality. I was trying to think, I didn't really write about it because I couldn't think of another example, but there are these things in sport that you go like Moeen Ali or David Gower's cover drive or Ian Bell's cover drive, and like Henry Slade's little like passes in the midfield, you're like, God, there's some stuff in sport where you just go like, that looks so nice. And he was like, Gloucester weren't amazingly good, and he had one of those games where he just sort of drifted around and was brilliant, so honourable mention to them. But my sort of goddesses of the week, I suppose we got to tip the hat to the Red Roses for their three-peat Grand Slam, and Alex wrote a really good detailed piece about what can be done to kind of revamp the women's game or make it less predictable, perhaps, in the Six Nations particularly, and how we can build up the other teams and help them out a bit more. But you've still got to give loads of credit and props to the Red Roses for doing that and expanding the game, putting the Grand Slam aside. They always usually do beat France, but to put them away from home, back-to-back-to-back slams is not a bad achievement. So the goddesses can be the Red Roses, with a god in John Mitchell, I suppose, in the coaching box too.
I'm going to give an honorary a name check to Harry Thacker, who's been one of my favourite players in the Premiership pretty much for his whole career, Leicester and Bristol, and came off the bench, and they've got two, Gabe Ogre and then Harry Thacker. It's a great double act, isn't it? But Harry Thacker came off the bench, and just his role in Bristol's surge to win that game was brilliant to see. But I'm going to go for Owen Farrell, because just the way that he managed that game, controlling it, but then in the moments when it needed some like a proper vision, creativity, he delivered that as well. And we're not going to see him for much longer. So, Owen Farrell.
Enjoy him whilst you can. It seems to be the way a lot of Saracens results that, you know, like when they beat Quinns, we were all there saying, oh, Farrell played well. Like when they're getting these results, it is Farrell leading that team.
It's his time of year, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. Get in touch with us. The email address is theruck@thetimes.co.uk. Enjoy all the rugby coming up this weekend. We will be back with you next Monday to review it all. And before that, make sure you follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcast from.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on, settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books, contacts, calendar, double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility, there's more to iPhone.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.